with the topic of horizons and singularities. Mostly in the context of cosmology, but we do a little bit of black holes as well. But first, some general study about this. We need a good way to visualize space-times with singularities and horizons to be able to better discuss space-time's properties. But space-time is usually thought to be infinite, or at least very, very large. So how can we get a good geometric description of it? For that purpose, so-called conformal diagrams or Penrose diagrams are useful. And let's start out developing those diagrams. They are all based on a certain theorem that we will now state and prove. Okay, first, local causal structure. The metric defines, as we said, the shape of a manifold in the case of a Riemannian manifold. Now, in the case of a Lorentzian manifold, where there is time involved as well, the metric, again, has to carry all the burden of describing all of it, and that includes the causal structure of the space-time as well. So the metric defines, or through the metric, when the metric is given, we can find out whether two events are space-like to each other, or time-like, or light-like. If they're space-like to each other, then no signal can travel between the two events. If they're light-like, then light can make it, or anything massless can make it from one event to the other. If they're time-like, then even matter can, in principle, travel between the two events. Now consider an arbitrary point of the manifold. Let's say P is some event in our space-time M, and consider what is called a convex normal neighborhood of the point P. A convex normal neighborhood is a neighborhood of the point for which it is true that every point in that neighborhood is connected to our point P by a unique geodesic. See, sometimes there can be two or more geodesics that connect two points. In a convex normal neighborhood, by definition, we have only exactly one geodesic that connects P to all of the points of its convex normal neighborhood. So that's a matter of definition. And there's a lemma which says that there always exists such a neighborhood. We can always consider a region small enough around an event P such that any events are connected in that little neighborhood, are connected to P by only one geodesic. So let us consider neighborhoods that are small enough to fulfill that criterion. Now, in such a neighborhood, let us draw a little more coordinate system. So we have a spatial coordinate towards the right, a temporal coordinate upwards, and here's the event P. And I'm also plotting the past light cone of that event P. And since this can be in general a curved space, I'm indicating that by drawing here somewhat wavy lines. Of course, what shape this takes, this line takes, depends on the coordinate system and on the curvature. Now we say that For the laws of matter fields, psi, to be called locally causal, and therefore reasonable, therefore being reasonable candidates to qualify as laws of nature, the equations of motion must allow one to calculate what's going on over here from knowledge only of what went on over there. The idea is that if you know what the matter fields, what all the contents of the universe were doing over here, you should be able to calculate what goes on at that event P there. Everything that's outside that stretch, for example over here, should not be necessary. We should not need to know what went on over here to calculate that, because any signal would have to travel faster than the speed of light to get there. So we expect that anything that's out there does not affect the physics of this event. This event has only a finite size, finite radius light cone, backwards light cone. Mathematically speaking, we are making here the assumption that everything can be predicted about that event here if we know all the physical field's amplitudes on such a space-like hypersurface here, just this stretch. But not only the amplitudes, but also we allow that we might require the time derivatives as well. Just like in ordinary classical mechanics, you need to know not only the position at the beginning, but also the velocity at the beginning to be able to calculate how the system is going to evolve. So here we will allow that we may have to know the amplitudes as well as the derivatives, the time derivatives of the physical fields over here, but not infinitely many derivatives, just finitely many. In practice, just one should survive. Should suffice. You see, if we allowed for infinitely many time derivatives, and if we assumed the fields to be analytic, we would really know everything about them anyway. See, we consider, for example, a field amplitudes over here. If it is an analytic field, if it has a Taylor expansion with infinite radius of convergence, then knowing all of its derivatives here would imply knowing it everywhere, right? Because if you know all the derivatives, you can write down the power series. Has an infinite radius of convergence, so you know the function everywhere. So in order to really stick to local statements, we have to restrict ourselves to a finite number of derivatives. Okay, so we say that laws of nature, laws of matter fields, are locally causal if they can predict what's going on over here on the basis of knowing only the amplitudes and a finite number of derivatives over there. This is, by the way, in contrast to Newton's theory, where there's no such thing. Because in Newton's theory, the speed of light is infinite, and therefore everything in the past could influence what's going on over there. Only in relativity do we have that the zone of influence is finite. So equivalently, we can say that the laws of matter fields are locally causal if signals can be sent between events Q and P only if there is a curve between Q and P whose tangent vectors are everywhere non-space-like. Remember, non-space-like means either time-like or a moment or light-like, meaning traveling smaller than the speed of light, or if it's light-like, then at the speed of light. Yeah?
Are we including gravitational field as a matter field?
No, just matter. That's important because we are here not considering the dynamics of the space-time itself. In principle, you could imagine a dynamics of space-time itself, which creates wormholes or other weird features that would seem to allow things to travel faster than the speed of light. Space itself might expand at a rate such that two points travel apart from each other at more than the speed of light. So here we are making the assumption that background space-time and its evolution is given. We are looking at a patch small enough so that any two points are connected only by one geodesic. Then we can draw a picture like that. And then we say that laws of nature, dynamical equations for matter, are called locally causal if they predict on the basis of only a finite region of influence in the back. So now, here's a question. Assume that on a differentiable manifold M, on some spacetime, only the causal structure is given. So let's, by that I mean, let's assume that on a differentiable manifold, we are not given the full metric, but instead, somebody will tell us on request whether or not a particular vector is time-like or space-like or null. That's all we can get from that person, right? So we have differentiable manifold, and we are not given the metric, but we're given the information for every vector, whether it is time-like or space-like or light-like, that is to say, or whether it's not. So we are only given the causal structure, which is to say we are being told whether a vector is pointing in a time direction or in a space direction or in a light-like direction, right? And then the question is, this is some partial information about our space-time. How far does it go? How far is a space-time determined by knowing only its causal structure? If all we know is where the light cones are, right? Whether like this or like that, so on. So you think of it this way. You're given a differentiable manifold, not the metric structure on it. You're not told what it is. There is one, but you're not told what it is. But at every point of the differentiable manifold, somebody draws for you the light cone, forward and the backward light cone. Okay. Then how much does that tell you about the space-time? The amazing thing that was found out by Stephen Hawking and others is that it tells you almost everything about the space-time, just to know where the light cones are, which direction they are pointing. In fact, the causal information of about the space-time tells you everything about the space-time up to a conformal factor, up to a conformal function. So up to local enlargement or shrinkage, which is not defined, not identified by the causal structure, up to that, everything is given. So here's the theorem. And that theorem is at the basis of drawing conformal diagrams, of drawing Penrose diagrams. So the theorem is, assume that on a differentiable manifold M, we don't know the metric, so we cannot evaluate the metric on two vectors. Remember, the metric is a twofold covariant tensor field. It feeds on two tangent vectors, and we write it in this way. We could, of course, also write g mu nu, and then contract that with the xi mu and then eta mu. But let's just cut down on the number of indices, so we just write it as g evaluating on two vector fields. So the theorem says, assume we don't know how to evaluate that. However, assume that for all events of the manifold, that at all events of the manifold, for all xi, for all tangent vectors, we are being told whether this xi is space-like, light-like, or time-like. So we are given the sign, the signature, of the metric evaluated on the tangent vector. This is just the length of the tangent vector squared, right? And remember that in relativity, the length of a tangent vector can be positive, or the length squared can be positive in the case of a space-like vector. It can be zero in the case of a light-like vector. It can be negative. The length squared can be negative in the case of a time-like vector. So all we are told is whether or not this the sign in front of that length squared is positive, negative, or whether it's perhaps zero. So at every point of the manifold, for every tangent vector, we are being told whether it's time-like, light-like, or space-like. Then, says the theorem, this information already determines the metric tensor, and therefore all of this, up to a conformal transformation. Which is to say, we can actually, from that information alone, we can get g mu nu of x up to some scalar prefactor function c of x. And remember, conformal transformations affect only the length of vectors, but conformal transformations leave their mutual angles invariant. So let's define the angle. for the cosine of the angle between two vectors, psi and eta, in the usual way. It's just that you plug them into the metric. That's basically what in linear algebra you would write as psi dot eta. So you contract the indices of psi and eta with those of the metric, and then you divide by the length of the two vectors. That then you call the cosine of the angle. And clearly, if you multiply g with some prefactor, then that prefactor will also show up here and there, and you take the square root of it, so overall it drops out. So conformal transformations are angle preserving. They're only changing the lengths of vectors. They can locally blow things up, locally shrink them, but the angles between vectors are preserved under conformal transformations. So how can that be? Let's prove it. I think this theorem is pretty nice. It's very useful because it will allow us to create Penrose diagrams. But also, I think it's probably profound. Maybe there is a way to study quantum gravity too in this way, where you identify the degrees of freedom of your space-time as the causal structure plus a conformal factor. I don't know of any approach that would pursue this, but it seems, well, it could be a possibility. All right, so here's the proof. Takes a few pages, so take a deep breath there. Okay, so consider a time-like vector field psi and a space-like vector field eta. So the length squared of psi is negative. The length squared of eta is positive. This thing, as we said, is time-like. This one is space-like. Let us consider the linear combination of the two. A linear combination with the linear combination factor eta. Now, what is that vector? What is its character? Is it time-like or space-like? Now clearly, when lambda is equal to 0, then that one is absent, the term. This one is time-like. On the other hand, if lambda is really large, like a billion, then clearly this vector is not going to matter that much. This one is space-like, so we expect the whole thing to be space-like. So let's ask, is there a value of lambda where we transition and this linear combination goes from time-like to space-like? We expect so, right? If yes, if there is such a lambda, then that lambda we can assume to be given. Because we assume that we're given the causal structure of the space-time, and we want to prove that this determines the metric up to scalar factor. So we're given the causal structure of the space-time, which means that we are told for every vector whether it is time-like, space-like, or null. OK, let's see whether there is such a lambda. We need to solve this quadratic equation in lambda. Namely, see, we want to find a lambda such that this vector is light-like, is null. So the condition that this vector is null is that when we evaluate it on the metric, so we plug it into the metric twice to calculate its length squared, then we get a function f of lambda, and we ask this to be 0. We ask the length to be 0. For what lambda is that length squared 0? Let's see. This equation has two roots because it's quadratic, right? It's a quadratic equation in lambda. It has, therefore, by the fundamental theorem of algebra, two roots, lambda 1 and lambda 2. Are they real numbers or not? Well, psi is time-like, and therefore, f of 0, when lambda is vanishing, is negative, as we said before. That's what it means, if psi is, time-like. On the other hand, as we already discussed, when lambda is large enough, then eta dominates, but eta is space-like. So therefore, the f of lambda goes larger than 0. So therefore, because the whole thing is continuous, it's a polynomial after all, it has to go through zero. There's got to be, therefore, a lambda for which this polynomial is equal to zero. That tells us that this equation has at least one real root. There's at least one value of lambda where it is zero, where this polynomial is equal to zero, and that lambda is a real number. But we know from the fundamental theorem of algebra that if there are two roots and one is real, the other one is real as well. Now, remember, we are working here on the assumption that somebody tells us what the causal structure of a spacetime is. Somebody tells us we are given for every vector the information whether it's time-like, space-like, or not. So that means that we can assume that those numbers, lambda 1 and lambda 2, are given. Because we can ask whoever gives us this causal information, you know, for every lambda, we can ask, oh, is it time-like, is it space-like, is it null, and we get the answer, right? So in particular, we will find out for which two values of lambda this vector is null. So the two vectors, the two numbers, lambda 1 and lambda 2, can be assumed known. Now, here's a lemma, namely that the length of the vector xi squared and the length of the vector eta squared, those two length squares have a ratio which is given by lambda 1 and lambda 2. That is the useful information because it means that from the causal information alone, we can get that ratio because lambda 1 can be assumed known and lambda 2 can be assumed known, as we said earlier. So if that lemma is correct, then knowing just the causal information about the space-time gives us the ratio of the length squares of any time-like and any space-like vector. So let's prove this. Let's prove that this ratio is lambda 1, lambda 2. Okay, so we know that this is equal to 0 for lambda 1 as well as for lambda 2. This is by definition what the lambda 1 and lambda 2 are. They are the roots of that equation. So let's spell it out. For lambda 1, this equation spelled out is that the length of xi squared plus 2 lambda 1, and then the inner product between xi and eta, plus lambda 1 squared, the length of eta squared. Right? I'm just spelling this out. And similarly, we get an equation for lambda 2. In those two equations, we have g of xi and eta occurring. So we can combine those two equations to eliminate this term. And then we end up with an equation that has only g of xi and xi and g of eta and eta in it because the mixed term drops out. We eliminated it. The equation that we obtain, the equation between the g xi xi and the g eta eta, is this one. Is the one that we had to prove. I leave it up to you to actually, you know, do that little elimination and calculate that. So indeed, knowing just the causal structure tells us when vectors are null. This tells us the lambda 1 and the lambda 2. And that tells us the ratio of any length of time-like and space-like vectors. As a corollary, we obtain that the causal information alone also gives us the ratios between any two time-like vectors, and in fact also any two space-like vectors. Why is that? Well, it's because the ratio between the length squared of a time-like vector and a space-like vector, we just saw, is given by lambda 1 and lambda 2. Then if we take the ratio between another time-like vector's length squared and the length squared of eta, then that is also given by numbers that are given from just the causal structure. Let's call them lambda 1 prime and lambda 2 prime because we used xi prime here. But since this is known in terms of lambdas and they are given from the causal structure, and that is given by known numbers, well, if you just take the ratio of the two, we find that indeed also the ratios of the lengths of any time-like vectors can be assumed given from just the causal structure. And you see where this is heading. We are not really getting fully the lengths of vectors, we're just getting ratios of length. That's why we will end up being able to get the metric, but only up to a conformal factor. So here's another corollary. Consider arbitrary non-null vectors, alpha and beta. Then that equation holds. To see that, just multiply this whole equation by 2. Okay, get a 2 over there, this 2 goes away. And then look at this term here. When we spell that out, that's just the length squared of the vector alpha plus beta. This gives us the length squared of the vector alpha, it's this one. The length squared of the vector beta, that's that one. And then there's also the mixed term, that's this one with the 2, right? Okay, so this is just spelled out the length squared. Okay, so now let's divide that equation by the length squared of some vector xi. Just took that entire equation and divided it by g of xi and xi, where xi is one of those time-like vectors. Then remember that all those ratios are known. They can all be assumed known because they are just the ratios of some vector length squared, some vector length squared, and independently of whether we have time-like or space-like vectors there, we can always express it in terms of lambdas, and the lambdas are given from the causal structure. So all of the right-hand side is given by the information that is contained in just the causal structure. But look at the left-hand side. The left-hand side is the metric. Is the metric applied to two arbitrary vectors, alpha and beta. Completely arbitrary. So what this tells us is that from just the causal structure of the space-time, from just knowing whether vectors are tangent vectors are time-like, light-like, or space-like, that information alone, the position, therefore, of the light cones, gives us the ability to evaluate the metric on arbitrary tangent vectors, namely in terms of those lambda expressions there, except that we don't get the metric itself, we get the metric divided by this function g of xi xi. But that's just some function. It's always the same function, no matter which vectors we choose over there. So what we obtain is the metric g alpha beta up to some scalar prefactor that we cannot further determine. So by just knowing the position, I mean the orientation, by just knowing which way the light cones are pointing, we can get the metric g alpha beta, we can evaluate g alpha beta at all points of the manifold for all pairs of tangent vectors alpha and beta up to a scalar prefactor. And that was the claim of the theorem. So that we've proven now. So the amazing interpretation of that result is that the causal structure alone already determines the angles between any two vectors in space-time. I mean, any two tangent vectors at any point in space-time. It determines those angles precisely, but doesn't really determine the length of any vectors. It does determine relative lengths, though. It doesn't determine the absolute length. It determines the absolute length only up to a scalar universal, a positive scalar universal prefactor function. So the useful implication of this is that space times M, G, so differentiable manifold with a metric on it, and M, G tilde, same differentiable manifold, but a different metric on it, two such spacetimes which have metrics that differ only by a scalar prefactor, and that differ therefore only by a conformal transformation, something that changes the length of vectors but not their angles. Any such pair of spacetimes has the same causal structure, same structure when it comes to horizons and singularities, for example. Any two such spacetimes are in what is called a conformal equivalence class. These two spacetimes are not isometric. They don't have the same shape because they don't have a diffeomorphism in between them that would respect the metric. G is not G tilde. But the two metrics differ from each other only by a scalar prefactor that's positive. And so we say that they're conformally equivalent. This is useful for practical purposes, because we can take a spacetime that extends out to infinity, for example, and then look for a spacetime that's much smaller, where we shrink everything. We use the prefactor phi to shrink everything so much that it's actually a finite size, but we preserve all angles. We preserve the light cones in that shrinkage process. So we can actually draw little pictures and get the full causal structure of the space-time. We simply draw another member of the conformal equivalence class, knowing that the causal discussion will be the same. Of course, how far two things are cannot be easily read off from one of those little pictures, because there are all these shrinkage factors in there. But whether or not two things can influence each other can easily be read off, because the light cone structure will be the same. So in particular, if we choose the light cones to be drawn at 45 degrees, we can preserve that those 45 degrees. So that leads us to those conformal diagrams, so-called Penrose diagrams. Consider, for example, the simplest possible space-time, Minkowski space. Ordinarily, we would write the metric being a twofold covariant symmetric tensor in this way, where we have the typical metric tensor with a minus 1, and then plus 1, plus 1, plus 1. Okay. We can transform the representation of the metric tensor into spherical coordinates. They don't affect the time coordinate at all, just stays the same, except I'm calling it dt now instead of x naught. And then we have a radial coordinate, which runs from 0 to a plus infinity. And we have the angular, or the spherical angular part, r squared d theta sine squared theta, d phi d theta, d phi d phi. The range of the variables is that the time coordinate runs from minus infinity to plus infinity. The radius runs from 0 to plus infinity. The phi angle runs from 0 to 2 pi, and the theta angle runs from 0 to pi. Now, how can we visualize Minkowski space on a little diagram of finite size? Well, consider the space-time given by another differentiable manifold, M tilde, or M bar, and the metric G bar, where the metric takes this form now. In the barred variables, there's a dt bar, tensor dt bar, etc., and there's a sine squared here, and so on. Now, that manifold doesn't really look conformally related to Minkowski space, because it doesn't look like it's just a prefactor. This metric is just a prefactor times the other one. But we shouldn't be prejudiced in this, because remember, we can reshape the way that the metric tensor looks in many ways, simply by changing coordinates. And indeed, there is a diffeomorphism. There is a change of coordinates, which will show that the two metrics are conformally related. Namely, consider this diffeomorphism that maps from the barred variables, T and R, and the angles stay the same, the identity operation for the angles. Consider the diffeomorphism that maps the barred variables, T bar and R bar, into the unbarred variables, the ones of the original Minkowski space, in this complicated way. Obviously, somebody thought very hard about this one. Okay, so it involves tangents and so on. The tangents are actually very useful in this because they are what is going to do the squeezing or expanding. We want that we want to draw a little picture of all of Minkowski space. This transformation will allow us to do it because the T bar and the R bar don't have to range very much for the tangent to blow up and to range all the way from minus infinity to plus infinity. Right? Because the tangent goes from minus infinity to plus infinity as its argument goes from minus pi to pi. So actually, the T bar and the R bar have a constrained range only. And that suffices to make the T and the R run all the way from minus infinity to plus infinity. Actually, in the case of R, only from 0 to infinity, because the R is a radial variable. So it turns out that this is a diffeomorphism. And that diffeomorphism is not an isometric diffeomorphism. It doesn't map this metric into the metric of Minkowski space, but almost. It does it up to a prefactor. It turns out that the Minkowski metric is the metric of our barred manifold up to this scalar prefactor, which looks complicated, all right, but it's just a scalar function. So no matter how complicated it is, the point is that they are conformally related to each other. Therefore, they have the same causal structure. Even though, and this was the whole point of the exercise, the T bar and the R bar variables don't have infinite range. They only range in that interval here. And in those, I mean, in a region that is described by those inequalities here. And R bar being larger than zero, that's inherited from the radius of Minkowski space being in spherical coordinates being positive. Okay, so let's use now this new coordinates, this new manifold, which is causally equivalent to Minkowski space, to study the causal structure of Minkowski space. And here's one of those conformal diagrams. So we have the R bar variable drawn to the right and the T bar variable drawn upwards. The range of our R bar and T bar is only inside this triangle here. And the R bar plays the role of a shrunken radius, and the T, of course, T bar plays the role of a shrunken time variable. R equals zero, the origin of the spherical coordinate system is this line here, R equals zero. And space-like infinity, infinitely far away, that would be here. Called also I little zero, space-like infinity. Then if we have an observer that has mass, which is traveling, then that observer always comes from that point over here, travels somewhere. You see, this is finite radii here. See, every point in here has a larger distance from the origin if it's a bit further out, smaller distance from the origin if it's a little bit closer in. So this is far out, this is closer in, this is far out, this is closer in. And this is generally speaking late, this is generally speaking early. But of course, they are not linearly related to the Minkowski radii and the Minkowski time coordinates. But we still have, and that's the point of this diagram, that light travels as 45 degrees, this way or that way. A light ray that is moving outwards from the origin of the coordinate system is moving this way at 45 degrees. A light ray that is moving inwards is moving this way at 45 degrees. And any matter that cannot travel at the speed of light has to travel somewhere in that light cone. Going to have a tangent vector that is somewhere in here. Now it turns out that all of spatial infinity, all of the infinitely many radii, are squeezed in between radius equals zero and all the way over there, which would be radius infinity. In particular, if a spaceship, for example, came from the infinite past somewhere and traveled to the infinite future some other place, it always starts out here because all of the radii are squeezed together here into a point. It always emerges from that little corner over here and then travels and then eventually makes it back into, not back, but it makes it into that very corner over there. A light ray will end up elsewhere. If, for example, at this event here, here's a point, if you're standing there and you emit a flash of light with your flashlight, and you can either emit it towards the origin of the coordinate system, radially inwards, in which case it will travel at 45 degrees this way, or you can emit it outwards, in which case it will travel at 45 degrees that way. And of course, if you have it travel inwards towards radius equal to zero, then it will sort of reflect off that and then travel outwards again. Simply because a light ray that travels towards the origin of the coordinate system, well, when it reaches the origin, it will just keep on traveling. And then it's going away from the origin again. So a light ray will travel this way and reflect off that. It's a pure coordinate artifact. In any case, so light always ends up on that line here. See that? This is where light ends up. Matter always ends up over here at I plus, future time-like infinity. The future infinity for time-like travelers, time-like meaning those guys have mass, they cannot travel at the speed of light. One moment. Whereas light will end up here on that line somewhere, depending on when the light was emitted. And that line is called scribe plus, its future light-like infinity. Any light ray will end up here. Yep?
The constant R and the constant T curve that you draw.
Sorry?
The constant R and the constant T curve.
Yeah, I'm getting to that in the next picture over there. Okay, so all of Minkowski space is in here. Light ends up on those lines. If a light ray comes from the infinite past, it comes from here. Okay? If it goes away to the infinite past, keeps on traveling, it will hit this line somewhere over there. Okay, so just for explanation of the legend, of the notation here, a continuous green line will indicate some sort of infinity. A dotted green line will be radius equal to zero. And when we draw double lines, that will indicate a singularity. But Minkowski space doesn't have one, so we don't have a double line just yet. So more precisely here, let us look at several observers. For example, we can look at those lines here, the bright blue lines. This would be massive observers that travel, let's say, on a geodesic. That could be just somebody sitting there. It looks like the radius is increasing and then decreasing again, but that's not what it's doing. It's just that all of the radii are compressed into a smaller and smaller interval. So if somebody is sitting 10 miles out from the origin of the coordinate system, then that's a point down here in a very far past. It's a point very close to R bar equals zero. But then over there, it might be a point over here, and then it goes like that. Remember that the radii are non-linearly transformed from the proper radii of the Minkowski space. So straight lines look like curved lines in this picture, obviously, because we've done this squeezing there. So all these, R1, R2, R3, R4, are just material observers that travel at less than the speed of light. The tangent vectors are well within the opening cone of the forward light cone of light. On the other hand, here, this line is an observer who at that point decides to switch on his warp drive. Now, that warp is only going as fast as, he cannot go faster than the speed of light, but in any case, he switches on some really powerful engine and he keeps accelerating. Accelerating. Let's say at a constant rate, he's accelerating, which means that asymptotically, that observer will reach the speed of light. So he will become, or his trajectory will become as if it were light at the end. Not quite null, but very close to, which means that the tangent vectors will go pretty close. They will go asymptotically to 45 degrees, which means that an observer which eventually decides to keep accelerating will actually hit scribe plus instead of that point. And this line here indicates, for example, a light ray. Somebody switches on a flashlight, the light travels outwards and hits scribe plus eventually. Yeah?
When the light cone hits the boundary, it just continues upwards?
No, that's the boundary of, that's the end of the space.
No, the other boundary, the dotted line.
Oh, the dotted line. So if I send the light ray this way, is that the question? Okay. If I send the light ray this way, then it travels, physically speaking, towards the origin, radially towards the origin of the coordinate system. So the R is decreasing. It travels at 45 degrees because it's light. The R is decreasing until it hits the origin. But what does the light ray do when it hits the origin? There's nothing there. It's just empty Minkowski space. So it keeps traveling. So now it's a light ray that travels away from the origin, which means that it gets reflected and ends up there.
But the cone just goes up, right? The light cone is the future.
Well, light always has to travel at 45 degrees, either this way or that way. So it hits the origin, and then at that point, as far as the representation is concerned, it will sort of reflect and travel that way. But of course, in real life, it will just keep going.
So the question wasn't about the ray, but about the cone. So the future events.
Yes.
On point, all the events in my future just reflect off that wall. I mean, not reflect,
just... Yeah, as far as the representation is concerned, but it's just an artifact of using the spherical coordinates, right? So, because physically there's nothing happening at the origin. And so, yes, if you want to take the point at the origin and draw its light cone, it's only half a light cone. Now, we are ready to define what we mean by an event horizon. An observer has an event horizon. I mean, not every observer has an event horizon, but if an observer has an event horizon, it is the boundary of the past of this observer's future causal infinity. Was that clear? Probably not, right? That's technically the definition, but let me try this one then. The event horizon is the boundary of the set of all those events that could possibly influence that observer. Okay, so look at, let's just look at the concrete example. Remember that observer who was traveling quite normally and then thought, oh, I'm going to keep accelerating forever. Until I'm getting faster and faster, my speed is going to get closer and closer to the speed of light, which means that the angle gets closer and closer to 45 degrees, traveling eventually almost like light, and therefore it's asymptotically hitting scribe plus over there. That observer has an event horizon. How come? Well, let's look at it. The event horizon is the boundary of the set of all those events that could possibly influence our observer. So what are all the events that could possibly influence that observer? Well, for example, here, this event, could that influence our observer? Yes. For example, you could send a signal with light, let's say, at 45 degrees, and it will hit the world line of our observer, so it can influence. Similarly, if an event over there, well, sure, you can travel this way and hit the world line. You can, from here, you can travel and so on. But an event over here cannot communicate. From there, you cannot communicate to your observer. You see, you, everything you do will only influence the forward light cone. So it can at most go at 45 degrees, which is parallel to this line here, and will not hit the world line of our observer. All those events are not in causal contact to our observer's world line. Remember, this is the observer forever. This is the observer's future infinity. That's where the observer is going to end up. He cannot change his mind and then go that way. No way. This is his infinity. I mean, if the observer sticks to his claim of always accelerating, this is what is going to happen. He's going to end up here on Sky Plus at infinity. So the set of all those points, all of these, are points which can affect our observer. They can all send radio signals to our observer here. These guys cannot. And that's the boundary. This 45-degree line is the boundary between the set of points that can influence the observer and the set of points that cannot influence the observer. And that boundary is the event horizon of that observer, by definition. So this is the future causal infinity of our observer, this point here, and the past of that point on Sky Plus is all of this. Okay? So the future infinity, future causal infinity of our observer is this point, and the past of future causal infinity of that point is all of this, and the boundary of that past is that line, and that's the event horizon. This is what that sentence was saying. The event horizon is the boundary of the past of this observer's future infinity. Okay? But intuitively, just look at all the points that can influence our observer ever, and the boundary of that point, of that set of points, is the event horizon. Now, let's look at a more interesting case, because this was just, by the way, this observer has an event horizon. There's no black hole or anything like that present, but there's still a horizon. And there was this famous Canadian physicist, Bill Unruh, who said, well, this observer has an horizon. Maybe that observer also sees some radiation. Just like in the black hole case, there's a horizon. And it seems that from the horizon, there is Hawking radiation emanating. So Bill Unruh was asking, well, this observer sees a horizon. Maybe that observer sees radiation emanating from that horizon. And that's the case. That's Unruh radiation. But here are black holes now. Here's the black hole. It's a simple black hole. It's not rotating. So what happens to space-time, to Minkowski space, when there's a black hole is this. This course is going to be about is about cosmology more than black holes. So we're not going to go through all the details of the transformations and the Schwarzschild solution. But let's still exercise this Penrose diagram business with black holes. So here's a diagram for a Penrose diagram for a black hole. In fact, for all of the history of the black hole. And it's not just a little black circle. The black hole looks a little different. So here's Minkowski space. And you see that the past of it, I mean, the earlier half of it looks pretty much like Minkowski space looked. And here we have the surface of a star. This is a particle that's living at the surface of a star, let's say. And let's say that that star is collapsing to form a black hole. So initially, the star has a certain finite size. You might expect, therefore, that the star in the past looks like this, having a finite radius. But remember that this is a Penrose diagram. There's a lot of squeezing going on. And therefore, even if the radius of the star was constant for a billion years. In the Penrose diagram, it looks smaller and smaller just because of the projections, the way that the things are represented. So all of this here really means constant radius. Okay? So the star is sitting there burning away at a constant radius, roughly constant radius, let's say. But then, eventually, something happens, the star runs out of fuel, it starts collapsing, makes a bit of fuss, supernova and all that, but eventually it will collapse and the radius will go very small. And then if the star is heavy enough, what will happen is that it will actually lead to the formation of a black hole horizon. We will have an event horizon forming. The radius eventually of the star actually goes to zero, which is to say that all of it gets sucked into the singularity at the origin of the black hole. Let's see what we have here. This is still familiar, Sky Minus. This is where light rays would come from the past infinity. If you're sitting there, you can signal with light either 45 degrees this way, 45 degrees that way. All of this stuff is quite familiar, I guess. If you're traveling with a spaceship, you would be coming from there and then travel this way, always at less than 45 degrees, because you can't travel faster than the speed of light. And eventually, you'd end up over here, hopefully. Well, you could decide, just like that observer earlier, to accelerate away continuously. I mean, accelerate, go faster and faster, eventually reach the speed of light, or asymptotically reach the speed of light. In this case, you would be hitting Sky Plus, just like in the example earlier. Or you could decide to not hit the black hole and keep on going at less than the speed of light. In this case, you would end up over there in that corner. That plays the role of this corner earlier. But what's going on over here now? Here is the event horizon for the black hole that formed. Now let us look at that event horizon. How did that form? Imagine you were at that location at this point. Could you escape the black hole? Yes, you could. You don't have to end up swallowed by it, because you can travel at 45 degrees. Well, not really, because you're not light, but at almost 45 degrees, so you can travel like this and still make it safely. If, however, you are on that line, if you're an event on that line, then you would have to be light, okay? And you would just make it on the horizon of the black hole. So if you are, let's say, at this point, at this event, you're lost, okay? You will eventually, because you can only travel within the 45 degrees light cone, you will eventually hit this place here, which is the singularity of the black hole. No way to avoid it. If, however, at the same time you were at a further distance away, like here, you're still safe. At that later time, in order to be safe, you have to be all that distance away to be able to avoid being sucked in. If you are there, then you have to be this far away to be able to avoid being sucked into the black hole. Which is to say that at later and later times, you have to be further and further away, up until this point over there, which is the maximum radius. This is going to be the radius of the black hole horizon. So as the star collapses, the horizon's size is increasing at the speed of light. At the speed of light, up until it reaches the actual eventual size of the horizon of the black hole. So it's coming from the inside out, the black hole horizon. For the actual transformation from the Schwarzschild solution to a space-time that's conformally equivalent, where you have that picture, I'd like to refer you to the text by Susskind and Lindsay. Now, cosmology. How about Penrose diagrams in cosmology? Let's say for the case of k equal to zero, These are spacetimes that are spatially completely flat. There's no positive or negative curvature. And that's, of course, spacetimes that are spatially just like R3. And so therefore, it would be difficult to draw them on a piece of paper. We need a transformation that cuts them down to size. And that can be done similarly to Minkowski space. Again, angles will be preserved. For the actual transformation, I don't want to clutter the illustration with lengthy equations. You can find that in the textbook by Hawking and Ellis, chapter 5.3. There are the actual transformation equations. Here's the outcome. That's a representation now of a Friedmann, Lemaitre, Robertson, Walker spacetime. That's how that looks like. Now the upper half looks familiar. We see a double line at the bottom. That's a singularity again. Double lines stand for singularity. So we now have a singularity in the past rather than the case of the black hole where it was an option to fly into it in the future. But other than that, it looks pretty familiar, pretty much like Minkowski space, causally speaking. For example, this blue line here could be one of you. You're traveling there, always with the tangent that's within the 45 degree light cone. And eventually, if you don't keep speeding up, if you keep your speed finite below finitely below the speed of light, then you end up here at I plus, your future infinity. If, on the other hand, you decide to speed up eventually, accelerate, get asymptotically close to the speed of light, you end up on scry plus. What if you look at a point, at an event in space-time, and ask, what's its region of influence? What events were able to influence it? And you will find that, well, nothing could travel faster than the speed of light. So only those events here in that triangle were able to influence our event over here. This is as far as this event or an observer who's sitting there can see. An observer here cannot see anything that happened over there. Completely invisible. That's a kind of horizon as well. And it's called the particle horizon. The particle horizon of that observer. It goes as far back as things that could possibly influence that observer. The difference between the particle horizon and the event horizon, I will explain more a little later. So this is the Big Bang singularity. I should say, though, be careful, because not all Friedmann, Robertson, Walker spacetimes have a Big Bang singularity. For example, consider a spacetime that is dominated or has always been and will always be dominated by a cosmological constant. So the W parameter has been and always is equal to minus 1. In this case, we can solve the Friedmann equation easily, and we get exponential expansion. And so if the scale factor is expanding exponentially, then yes, it's going to be really rapid in the past, but in the future. But in the past, well, it's an exponential. Okay? It's an exponential. So it never reaches zero. The scale factor is never zero. The exponential function never goes to zero. Unlike those polynomial or power law space-times that have a definite starting singularity, not all evolutions have. Oh, and by the way, also be aware that it makes a huge difference whether space-time has a finite volume or has an infinite volume when it comes to that singularity here. Because if k is equal to zero, space-time really is of infinite volume, then if our space-time is described by a Friedmann-Lemaitre metric, which has a singularity in the past, then it means that, yes, the universe was shrinking. If you look at the evolution towards the past. The universe is shrinking, but its size is always infinite. So the galaxies always get closer and closer, but there's always infinitely much space anyway. And at the Big Bang, an infinite universe was created. It wasn't created small and then grew and suddenly somehow became infinite. No, it was created, came into existence at infinite size already. That's different when you have a universe that has the topology of a sphere. If you follow it backwards in time, then that actual sphere shrinks and its volume actually goes to zero at that singularity. So you see that Big Bang is not equal Big Bang. There are many different kinds of Big Bangs, and we will see that there are really strange kinds of Big Bangs and the reverse big crunches that can happen. Even mixed situations, where in some direction you could have an infinity, in other directions not. And so you could in some directions squeeze to a point and in others stay infinite, and you could have universes that roll up in a cigar-like thing or a pancake. There are many different possibilities for how such a crunch or the reverse, such a Big Bang, could look like. All right, so in particular, we can ask, how far back can we see? If we are now at 13.8 billion years old, we are 13.8 billion years old. I mean, the stuff we are made of is 13.8 billion years old. How far can we look back? How big is that? How far away is the furthest stuff that could possibly ever have sent a signal to us? It turns out that's about 40 billion light years away. The reason why that's not 13.8 is that stuff has been moving since. Space-time has been expanding since. But I'll show you how to integrate it up. Okay, so here's the particle horizon. The question is, how far away is the particle horizon at the time t, such as today? So here we are at event P. That's today's lecture, that event. And then here would be a light ray traveling at 45 degrees. And here we have the world line of us, the Earth. And the question is, how far is that distance there? Remember that in a Friedmann Lemaître space-time, the metric takes this form. This is just trivially the angular factor of spherical coordinates. And then the key thing is to have the scale factor here, the a squared of t factor. Let us consider a light ray. We need to find out how far could a light ray travel in the age of the universe. Okay? How far could a light ray travel in the age of the universe? If this was Minkowski space, easy, 13.8 billion light years, because it's been traveling for 13.8 billion years. But not so in an expanding space-time, because the space-time has been expanding while the light ray has been traveling. So the starting point of that trip has been increasing its distance from us because space-time has increased in size. So let's consider a light ray. Its path is gamma of alpha. Alpha is a parameter. It's not the eigentime because there is no eigentime passing when you're traveling along with the beam of light. So it's just a parameter that parameterizes the path of our light ray. So this is the time parameter gamma naught as the time gamma naught as a function of alpha. This is the radial position gamma 1 as a function of alpha. And let's just keep the angles at 0. So it's just an outwards flying light ray, see, radially outwards. Then we're dealing with a light ray. So the tangent vector to this path has to be light-like. It has to have a length squared, which is 0. So let's differentiate this position vector as a function of alpha with respect to alpha. So we get d gamma mu by d alpha. That's the tangent vector of the path. And we calculate the length squared of that tangent vector, it has to be equal to zero for this to be the path of a beam of light. Okay, that's simply d gamma zero by d alpha squared minus a squared of t, that's because of that, times d gamma one by d alpha squared. And that means, since this is the time variable, this is dt by d alpha is equal to plus or minus dr by d alpha, because gamma 1 is the radius. You see, this is the time, this is the radius as a function of alpha. Okay, so d alpha we can eliminate in this equation, and we simply obtain dr by dt is either plus or minus 1 over a of t. Plus or minus because it's either in or outgoing. The radius either increases or the radius decreases as the light travels. So we can integrate this now. We put the dt on the right-hand side and integrate the whole thing. So the integral over dr, which is the distance dp that we want to calculate, the integral over dr is equal to plus, because it's outgoing, radius is increasing, integral over 1 over a dt. This is what we have here. So travel from t equals 0 to t, 1 over a, t prime, dt prime. This is the integral we have to do. And we have to integrate it over the age of the universe, which is 13.8 billion years. And we have to make an assumption here about the evolution of the scale factor. So if we assume we know how it evolved, let's say, from the end of inflation, by assuming that it started out with a period of radiation dominance, then matter dominance, then cosmological constant dominance, then integrating this up, we arrive at approximately 40 light years. So this is the size of the bubble that is causally connected to us. Now, how is that related to event horizons? This was the particle horizon of an observer, like us. But do we also have an event horizon in our universe? Now, remember what the event horizon was. So far, we studied it only for the black hole and for the case of a uniformly accelerated observer. But let's look at it now in cosmology. So an observer's event horizon is, if he has, or if he or she has an event horizon, is the boundary of the past of that observer's future infinity. Okay? So remember what it was. You follow that observer all the way to that observer's infinity, not just to today. For the particle horizon, we integrated up how far a light ray can travel up until today. But in order to calculate whether there's an event horizon, we have to check, you know, we have to look at the observer's complete history to future infinity and then ask which events are able to influence that observer at some point in that observer's history, anytime, up until to infinity. And if there are events that cannot influence that observer ever, the boundary of that region between being able to influence or not, that boundary is the event horizon. So here's the case without. Here is a Friedmann, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker spacetime. The singularity here for the Big Bang. Radius equals zero. Here is somebody traveling all the way to plus infinity, to I infinity. So now let's follow one of those, let's follow this observer here all the way to infinity. And let's ask, which events can influence that observer? It turns out all of those events, all of them, they can all influence our observer. If you're sitting here, fine, you just send a beam of light this way, 45 degrees, you will hit that line somewhere. Over there, you can always do it from here, no problem. No matter where you are, you can always influence that observer. maybe late, maybe early, but you can influence that observer. So therefore, there is no boundary to that region. It's all of it, all of space-time, that can influence our observer at some point, and there is therefore no event horizon in this picture. But there can be other Friedmann, Lemaître, Roberts, and Walker space-times, and their Penrose diagram looks like this. And we will calculate in a moment what it takes for the picture not to look like that, but to look like this. But when it does look like that, you see, this angle here is more shallow. When it does look like that, then the Coase structure changes. Here's an observer again, and we follow that observer till all eternity. I plus, that's future causal infinity of that observer. Which events are able to influence our observer? Well, it's all the events that are in this triangle here, that are in the backwards light cone. All those events are able to influence that observer. If you're sitting here, no problem, send a beam of light. If you're sitting here, no problem, you can influence that observer, send a beam of light. But if you're here, you cannot. You cannot ever influence that observer because you would have to send whatever you send. You know, the fastest is a ray of light, and it can only go at 45 degrees. It's going to hit over here somewhere at Scribe Plus. But it's not going to hit our observer at any time. The events over here cannot ever influence our observer. Therefore, the region that has an influence on our observer has a boundary, and it's given by this yellow line. So that's the event horizon of this observer here. So the question is, if we integrate up, not as for the particle horizon, you see, for the particle horizon, we were integrating up how far can light travel in 13.8 billion years, right? We're asking, how far can light travel in 13.8 billion years? That gives us the size of the particle horizon. We can also ask, and this is the question for the event horizon here, we can ask, how far can light, the fastest signal, travel ever up until time infinity, right? And the question is, can a light ray reach everywhere in space-time or can it not? So the question is whether that integral that we did for the particle horizon converges or diverges here. Yeah?
We saw that FRW is conformal to flat. I can imagine on the left-hand diagram, it's really...
Wait. When you say it's conformal to flat, that's not quite right because we have singularity here, right?
Right, but...
So it's not conformal to Minkowski space.
It's conformal to sort of half of it in that case, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, but be careful, not quite, because you can have this picture or that picture. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference there.
Yeah, I was going to ask,
yes.
What does it mean in the right-hand side?
Yeah, I'm getting to that.
Okay.
So the question is, you know, whether you can reach all the way to I plus or not in that integration over there, whether your particle horizon will eventually be all of the manifold or not. And that's the question of whether that integral is divergent or convergent. Now remember that the scale factor we had a formula for. We calculated the scale factor as a function of what the equation of state parameter W is. And we obtained that. Now we have to integrate 1 over that. We have to integrate 1 over the scale factor. So remember that for this to be convergent, this has to go like 1 over t. Well, if it goes like 1 over t, it's still divergent. It's like logarithmically divergent. But if it goes like 1 over t squared, or in fact, if it goes like 1 over t to the power of 1 plus epsilon, then it's already convergent. So the threshold is at 1 over t to the power of 1. So when is this 1? Because we take 1 over it, right? So when is this 1? It turns out that is 1. You can actually read off right from the equation here. That is 1 if w is equal to minus 1/3. W is equal to minus 1/3, then you have here 1. Minus 1/3 is 2/3, but 2/3 divided by 2/3, that's 1. So if w is minus 1/3 or smaller than that, then we have an event horizon. Then there are events that are so far away from each other in space-time that they can never, ever communicate with each other. Because light may be starting to travel towards the other, but even though, you know, light travels at the speed of light, more space is being created in between them through the expansion as the light is able to cross in a finite amount of time. Right? I mean, in that amount of time. So it's hopeless. The light travels and goes as fast as it can, but this, the expansion is overwhelming. Never makes it. So the criterion for the existence of an event horizon is that W is smaller than minus 1/3. And it seems that we are definitely in that regime now. Because apparently we are very close to W equal to minus 1, or perhaps even smaller than minus 1. So apparently we do have an event horizon. So if space-time keeps doing what it does now, there really is a huge part of it that we will never know about. Right? So the particle horizon now is 40 billion light years across. And everything that's like 50 billion light years away from us, we cannot know about. But if we wait a while, we will learn about it. Okay, we just have to wait like 10 billion years. And then our particle horizon will be like 50 billion light years, right? So we will learn about it. But as what we just calculated is there will be stuff sufficiently far away. There is a border. There is not really a border, but there is a threshold distance. I don't know where it is. I mean, nobody knows where it is. Maybe it's like 200 billion light years away or so. And that stuff we will never learn about because the expansion rate of the universe is such that this stuff that's like 100 billion years light years away from us is getting away from us at a rate such that light cannot catch up with it. We will never, ever learn about these things that are over there. Even if we wait for an infinite amount of time, no signal from there will ever reach us because space is created at a higher rate in between. What's interesting about this is that the W smaller minus 1/3 is the criterion that we encountered earlier. Do you remember what it meant? When W is equal or smaller than 1/3, it means inflation. It means acceleration. That is, if a space-time keeps accelerating forever, it doesn't matter how much, but if it does accelerate forever, then it has an event horizon. If it just keeps expanding, that's not enough. It has to actually accelerate. Okay, that's it for the first hour today.